Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their work, the lessons they've learned, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, my guest is Jason Chatfield, cartoonist, comedian, and president of the National Cartoonist Society. Saying no to opportunities can be difficult for illustrators, especially early on. It is, as Jason explains, a vital skill to learn. He's still learning because when I asked him to be on the podcast, he said yes. Among the topics, we talk about what illustrators can learn from Jason's multi-hat wearing ways. He explains how comedians and cartoonists are cut from the same cloth. And in the fight against art theft from AI image generators, Jason reminds us that we are far from fighting alone. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Wow, did we just nail the tech part right off the bat?
Damn. This has to be some kind of a record. That never happens.
It's like my father-in-law likes to say after he and I do like a house improvement thing. He'll say, it's almost like we know what we're doing.
I like that. That's like me every time I finish a job.
Exactly. It's like almost, that cartoon is in the New Yorker. It's almost like I know what I'm doing.
Almost. Always, you know what? Every time I see something show up in print, That's the time that I see all the mistakes.
Of course.
That's immediately what I see.
It's like, oh, damn, he has six fingers. I hope no one notices.
Yeah. Well, I didn't do it using AI. It doesn't have six fingers. You know?
Sick burn, bro.
Yeah, who knew drawing hands was difficult?
Yeah, really. We all did.
Yep, artists did. Ask any artist.
I saw something recently posted where someone using AI posted something. Maybe it was on Reddit. I don't know where it was, but they basically said, hey, everyone, has anyone else figured out how to do hands? I can't quite figure out what prompts to put into my program for hands. And someone, without irony, commented and suggested, well, know what you could do? You could hire an artist to go into your final file and make those adjustments.
Oh my God.
Using Photoshop.
They were being sincere. That wasn't a joke.
No.
That gave me goosebumps. Ugh.
Anyway. So not too long ago, you were hanging out with Ed Sorrell. What were you two doing?
Well.
And also, I'm insanely jealous.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty big, as far as illustrators go, it was kind of like meeting the Pope in a way. Sure. I was terrified. I'll be honest. I was terrified to meet him because I've heard all these stories about what a Grinch he is, what a curmudgeon he is. Mm-hmm. But he's actually the sweetest guy. I'm ruining his reputation immediately by saying that. I was dropping off the Reuben Award, which is the Cartoonist of the Year, the highest award a cartoonist can receive. So he won the Reuben Award last year. He was unable to attend the award ceremony in Kansas City because he's in his 90s. But luckily, we both live in Manhattan, so Karen Green at Columbia hooked up a meeting that we could, you know, come around and talk shop, and I could drop off his little statuette designed by Rube Goldberg. And it was a very memorable afternoon. I honestly could have talked his ear off for hours and hours. Just as soon as you start talking shop with any illustrator, it's just you lose time.
Yeah. Did he tell you why he doesn't want to be on my podcast?
I mean, probably why he doesn't want to be on any podcast. Right. But no, what did he say?
Not interested. No capitalization, no punctuation.
Look, he's nothing if not great at word economy.
I like your take on that. Much more positive than mine.
Honestly, the ability in nearly 20 years of freelancing, the one skill that I'm yet to completely master is the art of saying no, and he has nailed it. He is an absolute master, not just of illustration, but of saying no, and that's tough. I mean, he's the maven. He's a master.
Yeah, I have a problem saying no. Of late, I'm getting a lot of requests from publicists at publishing houses. Hey, we have a new book out by so-and-so. Do you want to talk to so-and-so about a new book? To which I respond, no, I don't. I want to talk to somebody who wants to be on my podcast. I don't want to talk to somebody who wants to just pitch a product, right?
Yeah.
And I say it in a nicer way than that. But It's hard for me to type in, like, no thanks, like typing the letters. It's hard. It's very difficult.
It is, honestly. I think it's one of the most, they should teach it in art school. Like, I think at SVA and SCAD and everything, there should be a unit on freelancing and how to say no to the wrong things. Because as a freelancer, you just say yes to everything and figure it out
at
later,
first,
right? That's the credo. Right. Just take everything that comes in. And it's terrifying because you got to pay rent and you got to, you know, but then you wonder why you're working late on a Saturday night trying to finish a deadline because you just said yes to everything.
Right.
And I started to, about 4 or 5 years ago, I started to ask other freelancers, like, what are you saying? Like, what's your form email for saying no to stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was like, no, I have the same thing. I can't do it. And so I started this thing called November, which is every November for 30 days, you build up that skill, almost like a workout, but it's like, and I started just sending out, is one email every day, november.net is what I started, no-vember.net.
Right.
And it's just every day a new tip that I learned about learning to say no, because it's, honestly, I'm such a people pleaser, I can't, it's so hard. It's the most difficult thing that I...
Right. Well, I asked you to be on the podcast, and you really wanted to say no, but you just couldn't. Need to follow your
did
own advice.
Did I ask you or did you ask me? Because I'm a fan of the pod, so I wanted to be on. I don't know if you reached out to me or what.
I think Doug Little from Wacom connected us.
Yeah, that's right. He did too.
Yeah.
He's fantastic. I've been working with him for a very long time on sort of testing products and reviewing them and being probably more honest than they might like sometimes.
It's crap.
Yeah, well, there's been some products that never made it to market that I got to try that I was like, don't do this.
Yeah, he's the
Doug
best.
There's no hard sell. He's not traditional marketing. It's a Japanese company, so they're not like trying to just churn out phones or something. You know, they do one thing well, and they do it maybe every few years. And it's not like they're turning around a new one every 12 months. Like this latest one, I think it took them 4.5 years. This is why I like, this is the only company, with the exception of maybe Sakura or something, who actually I would have no problems putting my name behind promoting their stuff because they're really, really good at what they do.
Agreed. So speaking of you, sorry, Doug, if you're listening, you wear a lot of hats. Actor, comedian, cartoonist, president of the National Cartoonist Society, cheeky Australian, I've read. Where does your multi-hat wearing ways come from?
I think it comes from being in Australia and trying to make a career as an artist, honestly. In America, to a degree, you can specialize on something. You can be a children's book illustrator. You can be a editorial cartoonist. You could be a comic strip cartoonist. In Australia, there just isn't enough work to do just one thing. Mm-hmm. So I had to do everything. And just to make rent, I had to do live caricatures at events. I had to do book illustration, editorial cartoons, comic strips, caricatures, commissions, everything. And it just sort of bred. There's a good book called Range by David Epstein, which kind of explains the benefit of kind of having the ability to do a bunch of things. And then, you know, that's a good way to also find out what you're actually good at and what you enjoy.
Sure.
So yeah, you know, comedy is a nighttime sport. There's not a lot of comedy during the day. So I'm in my studio during the day and out at night doing comedy, and they pair quite well doing, you know, humorous illustration and cartoons.
Oh, we'll get to that.
It pairs nicely with being a comedian. And the National Cartoonist Society thing is really just that cartoonists are my favorite people, and I love spending time with them. They're the most interesting people in the world. I mean, the National Cartoonist Society, it's every interesting cartoonist that ever lived.
Right, so. Exactly. Founded in 1946?
Nailed it. 1946, right after the war.
I think the first president was Rube Goldberg, speaking of Rube Goldberg.
Correct. He was the founding president. Yeah, it started with a bunch of cartoonists drawing for the troops.
Chalk Talks.
Yeah, Chalk Talks, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they realized they really loved hanging out with each other and, you know, and then formed an organization.
I read that, and I just, that line there, they realized they liked hanging out with each other.
Isn't that, well, because it's such a lonely, solitary occupation.
I know, but it's I don't know, there's something about that that's really hilarious to me.
And so many cartoonists are introverts, and it's weird, but you know, you put a cartoonist in a room and they'll find the nearest corner and just sort of start looking at people, maybe drawing them. But you put cartoonists together in a room and all of a sudden they switch into extrovert mode. They can just talk, you know?
Right.
It's an interesting little dynamic, psychological dynamic.
Sure. So, I mean, you and I could talk for an hour about your acting and your like television experience, but speaking of cartooning, let's focus on cartooning. This
Sure.
is the
Yeah, I
Illustration
mean,
Department podcast, after
yeah.
all.
It's not the acting department
Acting
podcast. This
department.
is
As a cartoonist, so you've sold work to Mad, Variety, Wired, the New Yorker, and elsewhere. My guess is that, and you've sort of hinted at it already, that there's more than one similarity between writing a comedy bit and creating a cartoon, especially when they're both political. Is that a fair guess?
It is, and it's an interesting addendum you put on that, especially when it's political, because there's a ceiling on the time frame for a political cartoon. When I started being like wanted to be a cartoonist growing up, I was looking at editorial cartoons because they were the only things in my newspaper that I thought, well, that's a job that I could do. The comic strips were this far out thing that I was like, oh, only magical humans can do those. But there was something about editorial cartoon. I was like a real news nerd and a bit of a political wonk, so I really gravitated towards political cartoons, and I did them for many, many years, and still do some for The New Yorker. But it was just one of those things that that paired well with stand-up, because anything that wouldn't work as a cartoon, I could kind of try it as a bit on stage. And they're different audiences, they're different sensibilities. However, it's all the same principles. It's timing, it's word economy, it's the right choice of words, it's putting the right things in the right place so that your eye sees it at the right time. And there is a something of a science to, seeing the image, looking down at the caption, and then looking back at the image and getting the laugh. So there's, yeah, it's the same as delivering a certain line, a certain way with a certain facial expression. Not to get into the weeds too much on it, but yeah, there are some correlations there.
You refer to yourself as a clo as closeted with respect to your political identity as a comedian, but as a cartoonist, you're pretty out. I mean, you often skewer Donald Trump, for example. One such cartoon he said he liked, which when I learned about that, I just couldn't believe that story. I'll put the cartoon in the show notes, and he also blocked you on Twitter. So, I mean, what's this relationship with Donald Trump that you have?
Yeah, that was a dark day for me. If you ask any cartoonist, editorial cartoonist, like what's the worst thing someone you're trying to skewer could say to you? And it's, oh, I love it, or can I buy the original?
Oh, good Lord.
At least with the original, you get some cash.
Sure.
Yeah, I was doing a lot of political cartoons for The New Yorker, and something about Trump is, I hate talking about him, but
I know, I know.
during his tenure, there was this, I guess it was a folio, like a package of good news stories or news stories about him that would be delivered to him twice a day. To be the person that delivers that stack is a very reveal, like everyone wanted to be that person because then he associates you with good news. Anyway, the stack was on his coffee table, and a acquaintance of mine who happened to be a lobbyist was in a meeting with him, and as they were saying goodbye and shaking hands, he saw my cartoon on the top of the stack because it was that day's New Yorker cartoon, the Daily cartoon. And the guy said, "Hey, I know that guy." And Trump picked up the cartoon and he said, "Oh, I love it." I was like, "Oh God, don't tell. Why would you tell me that? That's the worst. That's, it was bad." And he had already blocked me on Twitter by that point. So I don't know. Maybe that's a badge of pride. I
He
don't
just, yeah, he doesn't know how to quit you.
know.
Good God.
Wish I knew
Well,
how to quit him. Yeah.
really. I mean, but it, in term, but back to like in terms of like your identity as
Yeah.
a comedian, as an actor, as a cartoonist, but like your political identity, your political views. I don't have to tell you that Americans have a propensity for outrage when they see a cartoon they deem unacceptable. Again, especially when it's political. When
Yes.
you create cartoons, does that worry you?
It does, and it never used to. I honestly, in 2012, I went to something called REDEP. It's this, they send one cartoonist from every country to France, and we all get together and do exhibitions and talks and drawing for the public. And we all talk amongst ourselves. A lot of them are political cartoonists. And, there are cartoon, like there was a cartoonist from China who was, in hiding because he was doing anti-propaganda cartoons, and another one who was exiled from the Sudan to Qatar because his family were threatened for his cartoons, and another cartoonist from Tunisia who had been drawing under a pseudonym because during the uprising, there was all these threats, and I'm thinking, God, you guys are freedom fighters. I'm a court jester at best. Like,
Right.
me and the UK and the US cartoonists are like, Jesus, we have it pretty easy. All we get is hate on Twitter.
Or
So
fired.
the
Or
you're
fired.
fine. That's true. Actually, that happened a lot. Many cartoon, Michael Diatta, Rob Rogers, a lot of cartoonists have been
Right.
fired for doing anti certain cartoons.
And both of them had like decades-long careers with those organizations.
Oh yes, definitely. I think the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette was a real, that was a big turning point, I think, for cartoonists getting fired for doing their job well.
Right, 2018.
Exactly. And yeah, so I do worry about it. I'm not, I try not to be too political in my comedy because I like the idea of stand-up being escapism. I don't want people to get into a club on a Friday night and have a couple of drinks and then have to be reminded about all the horrible crap in the world because they've had that all day and all week.
Right.
So I tend to do these days a little bit more silly, absurdist, escapist stuff that's sort of convex comedy. So I'm the butt of the joke. It's not concave. Concave, I should say, not convex. I just don't like reminding people in a fun scenario of things that are horrible,
Right.
unless you can really laugh at them, which is a good skill. That's a great comic can really turn something
What's the
ridiculously
deal with the
horrible.
apocalypse?
A good COVID joke is worth its weight in gold.
Yeah.
Everything now, and I say this really with having some pretty horrible experiences, even the most apolitical cartoon, people load politics onto it. So people come to an idea or a cartoon, or as they call them in the New Yorker cartoon, the contract you sign, they call them idea drawings. They don't call them cartoons. And so
What?
people bring their own stuff. They load onto your work what
Sure.
they, their own stuff.
Oh,
So
yeah.
even if you had no intention of, making fun of a certain thing or raising the ire of a certain group, people just project it onto it, and all of a sudden you're the worst human on the planet.
Right.
So there's that aspect as well. Sometimes you can't even help it.
Heck, sometimes it's clear, it is political, but it's very clear who you're trying to skewer or what critique you're trying to make, and people will still interpret it, even though it's crystal clear, they'll interpret it in a completely different way, as evidenced by Barry Blitt, who
Oh
did
God,
that
yeah.
New Yorker cover of the Obamas as terrorists.
The fist bump.
And he was criticizing the far right's interpretation of that as terrorism. That's what the point of the cover was. But the left, I hate to say this, it's my team, but the left just descended upon him. They dogpiled him. It like literally affected him in a negative way, physically, mentally, emotionally,
Yeah,
for
they
days.
really did. I really felt for him because I it was a very clear, I mean, to me, it was very clear what he was doing. But at that point, that turning point, after 2008, it really felt like the climate shifted on American politics. And I moved here. I'm from Australia, obviously, and I
Are you?
no, I just had a mild stroke. That's why I'm talking like this.
You've lived in New York too long.
Yeah, exactly. I had a real education when I moved to America because in Australia, you don't really wear your politics on your sleeve. You don't tell people how you vote. It's kind of a faux pas to do that. Unless you're in politics, you don't really tell people how you vote. It's kind of,
Yeah.
and so here it's not only worn, as a flag pin on your lapel. It's you literally associate every single thing about you to what that party believes. So there's no sort of middle ground where you're like, well, I'll take a smorgasbord, a bit of this and a bit of that, and I like this on the left and I like this on the right. Oh, I'm a bit of a centrist on this. You can't do that. You
Oh,
can't
God,
have
no.
any nuance or gray area. You have to be all in on one thing, and that's so. First of all, I mean, it's completely unnatural, but it's also
Right.
just, it's such a sport, it's a team sport, and that's tribalism at its worst, really.
Absolutely.
As an immigrant, I always found it really confronting working in that sphere. So, as I say, my politics, they're pretty clear, but they get twisted. I've had my cartoons recaptioned, and I know a lot of cartoonists have, and they go viral with the wrong caption, and people, contact me and go, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And I'm like, "Hey, I didn't do that." Even though my signature's on it. I know
Right.
Sarah Anderson has had some horrible, horrible stuff with that as well, and AI stuff, and
Oh,
yeah,
well,
it's a whole new world.
I have a note on that. Don't you
Yeah.
worry. Don't you worry,
Well.
Jason. We'll talk about AI. I know you're chomping at the bit about it.
Yeah, no, I'm, I don't know if jumping at the bit is the
Loading up the
right term.
pistol about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think my political position is pretty clear. I don't really rah-rah about it on the podcast. And to be honest with you and with the listeners, it's very much because I'm afraid that if I really lean into it and talk in depth about it, like you and I are doing right now, you and I are basically, everyone says don't touch the third rail. Politics is the third rail. I think you and I are firmly just sitting on the third rail, like we're sitting at a park bench or something, feeding pigeons right now. But it's hard to
Yeah.
even have like an open and honest discussion about ideas and an exchange, because I mean, hell, I so much as share a gentle criticism of a Democrat
Yeah.
with my friends in private who are all Dems,
Yeah.
and their response immediately is, "I'm a closeted Republican."
Well, I should just to put a button on that
Yeah.
is, if anyone's listening and want to look up one of the perfect example of this, I did a cartoon for the New Yorker during the election. I guess it was 2020, and it was a fight night poster. You know those old boxing posters, those illustrated, and everyone had like a nickname, and because Trump had a nickname for everyone, I had Trump and Biden, either side of the poster, and I had all these jokes, and I wrote it with my friend Scott Dooley, because we like to, like, he's good at, really good at parody, so we both did stuff for Mad Magazine together. So we pitched this to the New Yorker, they bought it, they ran it, and it was fight night, Sleepy Joe versus Donnie Bone Spurs. And the thing is, I was even handed in the criticism, truly. It was like, well, if they're going to call him Sleepy Joe, which is so silly, but okay, do it. Put them both out there. You wouldn't believe, you can look it up. It's on the New Yorker Facebook page. Oh my, it just a tidal wave of grief. And I was told that I was endangering democracy itself, by even enabling the parody of the use of the term Sleepy Joe. And I most of admittedly most of the jokes in it were anti-Trump, but truly it was like I the hyperbole that came up came at me after publishing that, and it was insane. And then it gave me an idea for another cartoon that ran in the New Yorker, which was a couple of boxing guys at the press conference, and they're saying, "You know what? We've decided we're going to settle this in the comments of a YouTube video," which is really where all the best debate happens, isn't
Oh my gosh, yeah.
it?
Well, look, if we're talking about political cartoonists, I think I'd be remiss not to mention some of the greats like Thomas Nast, Herb
Oh, yeah.
Bloch, Etta Holm, Rube Goldberg, which, of course, the great Tom Floyd.
Pat Oliphant, Jeff
Yeah,
McNally. We
on
could
and on
keep
for an
going. Yeah.
hour. Absolutely. But the point is, these folks were master critics of political and societal injustice.
Yes.
And they had, for the most part, I'm not saying it was like Shangri-La or anything, but they had, for the most part, like a supported platform. They had editors who trusted them, readers who wouldn't literally threaten their lives, things like that. I mean, if we're taking a little bit of a deeper dive here, Thomas Nast did have to worry about his life and his
That's
family's
true.
life because
Yeah.
he was going after gangster politicians. Tom Floyd faced racism and discrimination as a black cartoonist in the mid-1900s. My worry today is that outrage culture, identity politics, and the like has made us permanently averse to critical thought.
Wow. Yeah.
And how can we have a healthy society when we're afraid to criticize anything?
Yeah.
Like you see it in booking agents, right? I mean, you see
Oh my God,
booking agents
yes.
and club owners saying like, "Hey, dude, let's chill on the political stuff."
Absolutely, that's 100% true. It's you've been staring over my shoulder every gig. Yeah, so there are bookers who insist that you do not talk about politics, and then there's other bookers who go, "Ah, go for your life, whatever gets a rise out of them."
Right.
But yeah, there are definitely some, and agents, who just go, "Yeah,
And
don't talk
editors.
about that." Yeah. Well, see, okay, so I was lucky growing up. I started doing editorial cartoons for the local paper in Perth, where I'm from, and I would do six cartoons a week. I'd do everything in the paper just because I was there, and I'd pull ridiculous shifts. And so I was really part of a newsroom, you know, like a buzzing newsroom. And that's where I really cut my teeth as an editorial cartoonist. And I was very lucky. I had a good editor. He would support my ideas. If I had a position on something, he'd push back if he didn't agree, but at least he'd make me sort of solidify my argument. His name is Brian Mitchell. And he, ironically enough, now he's a politician. and for the Labor Party in Australia. But he always forced me to have to reinforce my ideas and defend them. And that was a really, really good thing, because sometimes I'd go, you know what? Yeah, maybe I just thought it'd make a good drawing. Maybe I do need to go back and you know, think about critically, think about this a bit more. And I look at Barry Blitz stuff a lot, and sort of see, you can almost see his thought process as he's going. His stuff in Airmail is great, when he does like a series, and you can see that he was either doodling while he was trying to come up with an idea, or there was a seed of an idea and he just built it out in a drawing. And yeah, there's definitely something to finding and reinforcing the ideas that you have, but then also like having an editor that will have your back. That's, I mean, it's rare as hen's teeth these days. You can't find them.
This episode is sponsored by Pencil Booth. With Instagram and Twitter not being as helpful as they once were for artists, there's never been a better time to start a newsletter to reach your most engaged audience without that pesky algorithm. But let's face it, most newsletter platforms are made for words, not pictures. Pencil Booth was developed by one of the world's largest illustration agencies as their own internal newsletter app, and is now open to the public. It's fun to use, made for artists, and all the content from your previous issues goes into a neat visual archive for a bird's eye view of your practice, like a miniature portfolio. Best of all, Pencil Booth is free for your first 100 subscribers, with plans starting as low as $1. Listeners of the Illustration Department podcast can get 25% off using the code ID25 at checkout. For more information and to start your free booth, visit pencilbooth.com. That's PencilBooth.com. Now back to my conversation with Jason Chatfield. I mean, should we, I think let's just like hit the, you know, last nail of the coffin here politically.
Sure.
I think it's worth noting that a lot of what you and I are talking about is seen on social media, and social media is not real. It is a percent of a percent of a percent of a percent of what actual human interaction is, especially in this, I'll just talk about it, in this country.
I deleted all my social media in 2021. I deleted everything for a full year. I wanted to do the experiment. I wanted to see if the world would end and if my career would collapse on itself.
No posts, no anything, no nothing, checking.
Nothing at all. No. I completely deactivated everything. And spoiler alert, the world didn't end. Everything, I mean, it felt like it at some time. It was during the pandemic, I guess. So yeah,
nice timing.
What I found was, you know, it rewires your brain. You stop thinking of things as they pertain to how they might be perceived on social media. Thoughts, right. Ideas, drawings, hot takes. You know, you stop thinking in tweets. You stop thinking in social media posts, or how, you know, what hashtag you might use.
Right.
And all I did was I consistently every Tuesday put out an email. I was at my mailing list. I'd been curating this mailing list for years for comedy to, you know, get people to my gigs. And then I was like, no, I'm just going to put out one cartoon every week. That's it, for free. Just one cartoon every week. And then maybe a paragraph on what I'm up to, and if people are interested. And then obviously a picture of my dog.
Of course.
keep people reading. Yeah, but it was a really interesting experiment, and I'm happy to say that, like, it really decoupled me from that wiring of social media.
Right.
Yeah, being the prism through which I see everything, you know.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that. I sometimes think in tweets.
Yeah,
like,
it's easy
that would
to
be
do
a good tweet. Yeah, often then delete them in my brain, move on with my life.
Well, isn't that a great feeling, though? Like, so I think with drawing, with illustration as well, especially, I think the sign of a good cartoonist, and correct me if you disagree with me here, but I think a great cartoonist has a waste paper bin full of scrunched up paper.
Oh, absolutely.
Tom Richmond put out an email today about a story. Well, he spoke to Jack Davis, who, if you've ever seen that great illustration he did, it was a boxing illustration, and it was absolutely gorgeous, but it wasn't quite right. It was fully inked, and it wasn't quite right, and he was asked to change it. He just threw it out and started over. I mean, if you saw it, you'd be like, oh my God, that belongs in the Met, you know. But it's always a good lesson to sort of not be afraid to kill your darlings, you know, not like. And that, I mean, working with art directors at ad agencies also helps with that. Because even if you're like, oh, this is beautiful, I love this piece, and they're like, yeah, we need to change the whole thing. You just learn to not get too attached to ideas and to executions and of an illustration. You go, all right, well, I guess we've got to change it and throw it out. Just you can have an idea, but you don't have to double down and have that sort of confirmation bias of everything now has to gravitate around that one concept or idea.
Oh, and by the way, if you have a thought, you don't have to share it.
Yes.
If you create
What
a
a
piece of art,
concept.
yeah, you don't have to post it.
And look, I might be getting some people's noses out of joint here, but there are some cartoons that people post, and I'm like, really? You want everyone to see that? Like, I get it if it's a process pick, like, that's great. But some people, they're posting stuff, and I'm like, is that your first pass? Is that a rough? Because that needs some work. And that's just me being critical. I'm way more critical of myself than anyone. You know, that voice in my head is just the most critical editor in the world. But
Sure.
I don't know. Sometimes people post stuff, I'm like, take another pass. You know, not
Well, I
happening.
mean, you and everybody else. I mean, Jack Davis as well. I mean, he literally admitted when he first showed his portfolio to the folks at Mad, or before that it was Tales from the Crypt, but same publisher.
That's right. Yeah.
He said about his portfolio it was crap, but they hired him
Yeah.
anyway.
I mean, yeah, was it Bill Gaines? Yeah, that sounds right. And speaking of Mad, just briefly, is that voice in your head that I'm talking about, like, it's also every art director I've ever had, every editor I've ever had. It's John Ficarra, it's Sam Viviano, it's Nick Meglin. You know, it's those voices that I hear when I'm drawing that are going, no, do it this way. Oh, no, that doesn't work. Do this again. And they're constructive voices. They're not destructive. But yeah, there's a great book called Drawing from Within by Nick Meglin, the late Nick Meglin, who was a editor at Mad Magazine. And he and I think his daughter Diane made it's honestly the one book I could highly recommend above everything else, Drawing from Within. And it's just exercises that help that whole process. It really is. There's that inner critic and, you know, all that stuff. It's just brilliant.
You know, speaking of posting, let me take a drink here first for a second, take a break. My lukewarm lemon water.
Nice. You're a pro.
When I talk to illustrators about Instagram, specifically Instagram, I often compare it to a comics, haha, comic workflow. Instagram is the seedy basement with the 20 drunks where you test out your material. And your website is the produced, polished special.
I like that. Can I yes and
Sure, please. Oh my
that?
gosh. Are we doing a thing? Let's do it.
Yes, and yeah, now we're in improv. I think that's a good way to look at it. And there's a great course. I think it's a 3-year course at the High School of Art and Design in New York. And Matt Lassen has this fantastic curriculum, this great syllabus, I should say. It actually has a whole unit on social media and how and what you should put on there, and to sort of curate it in such a way that does reflect something about what's unique about you. I would say yes, definitely. It's good to see. Like, I'm a process junkie, so I finished art, great. I'll go to the Society of Illustrators and see the 128. I'll go and watch it and see the finished art and go, wow, that's great. You know what I'm more interested in? The sketchbooks. I want to see the pencils. I
Same.
want to see all the behind the scenes stuff. And they have an exhibition. I mean, it was up in December, and I'm looking at John Cuneo's stuff, and I'm like, oh my God, look at these pencils. They're beautiful, you know. And it's rare because he's such an Alla Prima, you know, pen guy, you know. And I always want to see the back end. I want to look behind the curtain and see, hey, how did you get there? Like, what was your process? So for me, I absolutely love looking at people's pencils. The thing is, I know art directors from experience, like, friend art directors or friends and art directors professionally who look for artists on Instagram. They look for them on Instagram. So
Oh, so
if they're only seeing the pencils or only seeing process pics, they may well be able to go to discern, oh, actually, this person's a pro. I'll click on their website. But sometimes they do want to see what the finishes look like.
Sure. Well, I mean, some of the jokes that end up in your special are the ones you share in these CD dive bars.
Oh, 100%. I mean, every open mic is just full of seedlings of jokes that will later become a finishing, like a closing bit.
I don't know why, but I can just see you holding like a bunch of index cards. Like, oh, let me just try this one. Okay, so nope.
It's actually a scrappy moleskin, but you were close. Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Another one of your hats is being president of the National Cartoonist Society. Mm. Since AI-generated imagery has made its way into the mainstream discourse, a number of illustration organizations have put out statements condemning AI. The Society of Illustrators, 3x3, AIGA, Communication Arts, and the National Cartoonist Society.
That's correct. Yeah.
I guess my question here is, why are you such a Luddite?
Stop trolling me, Joseph. So I should make the distinction, and it's a very, very important distinction, that we're not anti-AI at all. We're not anti-artificial intelligence. We're not anti-technology. We're definitely not Luddites, and myself especially. I mean, I've been a staunch advocate for Wacom for a very long time.
Yeah.
So I'm always pushing people to use technologies and new tech. I always, go to Adobe Max. I always check out what Adobe are doing and what the new tools available. Mm-hmm. Including their AI tools, which are amazing. Mm-hmm. What we object to is the commercial use of AI-generated images that have been trained on copyrighted works. That's the big thing. And there is now, as I just saw it today, on your community forum, is the class action against these companies that create these tools because there are no ethical guidelines. There are no guide rails. It's the Wild West. And the legislators aren't really going to catch up to this for a while. They barely understand the technology, let alone know how to legislate, any kind of... And copyright lawyers are the same. They're like, well, technically this kind of falls into a gray area here, and there's pastiche, and there's montage, and there's collage, and there's all these things where things can slip through the gaps legally, but it's more of an ethical conversation.
Right.
And I think that's a really important thing, because AI generated art is here to stay. It's not going anywhere. Same with ChatGPT, same with video, automated generated video and AI generated photography. The key is to build in the ethical guidelines, watermarking or crediting or building in some kind of ability for the artist to opt out, which is almost impossible with AI generated art being trained with scraping art that, that artists haven't actually given permission to be scraped. Sarah, the aforementioned Sarah Anderson is a fantastic example of that. She wrote a brilliant op-ed in the Times, which she got a lot of hate for, obviously, because the internet. And I should say because social media. It really outlined a real world example, because people go, oh, come on, this isn't taking work away from artists. This isn't. And then you look at the cover of, I think it was Cosmopolitan. They did the cover was completely AI generated. And then the promotion for the winter program in San Francisco Orchestra, they used AI generated art for their Nutcracker. That was just last year. This year it's completely exploded. There are people who used to have regular gigs doing portraits and caricatures and illustrations that are completely just getting crickets in their inbox now, because the people are going, hey, I'm just going to go and use these other tools and get it for free. There was an exhibition in the lobby of my building, which was pretty upsetting, of AI generated art that was completely uncredited as to where any of the source material was scraped from. And there was some pretty clearly defined styles in there. Sarah Anderson had her style, all of her work sort of scraped, and then people can just generate cartoons of hers that look like her, including the handwriting, which is a really personal thing. Handwriting is such a personal thing. Just they can put anything, and there's white supremacy groups and neo-Nazi groups that are doing cartoons with her style, and people are coming to her going, you're a piece of crap, So, yeah, there has to be some kind of ethical guidelines here. And the NCS, the Society of Illustrators, along with a huge coalition of other arts organizations, the Graphic Artists Guild, the Copyright Alliance, Authors Guild, National Writers Union, American photographic artists and a ton of other cartooning organizations like CCGB and the PCO and the ACA, a lot of acronyms. Mm-hmm. Everyone is concerned about this, not because they think it's gonna completely usurp, you know, artists and art in the same way that Spotify didn't completely destroy music, mm-hmm. Music distribution, and you know, being able to profit as a musician, but it will definitely make a very big dent, and that is the issue at heart here. So
right.
It's a challenging thing to broach because it requires people to understand some really technical stuff mm-hmm. as to how it works. And I spoke today, the head of Andrews McMeel Syndication, the head of King Feature Syndicate, and also Wacom. And we're all sort of talking in the same way about sort of this thing is exponentially evolving just so quickly that it's hard to just keep a finger on the pulse of where it's at.
Right.
So this class action that just got launched is some way to go to build, to get some attention, I guess.
Right. Like my education on how law is written and then passed is basically boils down to seeing a cartoon when I was a kid.
Thomas Nast.
What do I? Jesus, I'm not that old. Whereas like my kids like to say, when you grew up in the 1900s.
Oh my God.
And it's true. Yeah. But doesn't it start that way? It starts with litigation. It starts with lawsuits. It starts with public outrage discourse, getting it to that level where it is discussed in a mainstream way. And then obviously it starts getting the attention of people who are in those positions. Hey, maybe your friend, the lobbyist might want to, I don't know if he's still a lobbyist, but that sort of thing where we push heavily and then gain political muscle.
This is how it works. This is the mechanics of this. Yeah. And you know, that's why we have, and I've never worked with all these other organizations before. We've never had to band together with, music writers and animators, like I see for Hollywood, like animators and the concept artists of society, like everyone is being affected by this. So we are all kind of just more than anything trying to get some media advocacy. We're doing a summit on the 24th and 25th of February with speakers from all the different disciplines, from art to music, visual art to music, animation, writing, photography, voice actors. There's deepfake voice technology using AI that completely voice actors out of business, which is crazy.
Yeah,
we all have to kind of band together to build some guide rails here.
When is this coming out and through what platform?
So if you look, follow the National Cartoonist Society or any of these organizations to find out what we're doing. I mean, the Graphic Artists Guild, the Concept Artist Society. Everyone is going to be plugging this. Yeah.
The one big takeaway and sort of heartening takeaway, I would say, is notice how many organizations and how many people are involved in this who are pushing back on this. Mm-hmm. That's pretty great. I mean, for folks listening, you're not alone. You're not like, oh my God, who's going to fight? Like, everyone's fighting this. Everyone.
Yeah. And it can feel very lonely when you see this and you just feel so powerless and you go, oh my God, who am I to stand up to these, giant Goliaths? And,
the illustration community is itself a Goliath.
Yeah.
Very much is.
AI Goliath. Yeah. There's a lot of organizations, actually quite big ones, that are getting involved. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how big this was, but the Romance Writers Guild, which is huge, I think it's Romance Writers Association or Guild Association, something like that. They are massive, and same with SAG-AFTRA are also getting in on this one as far as the deepfake conversation. They're pretty big organizations, so it's not like we're... And again, I hasten to add that none of us are Luddites. We're all using technology in our work because we have to work in this modern world. It's just that these tools, whether they become part of a workflow for anyone, need to have some kind of guide rails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just don't steal other people's shit and we won't get upset about it.
Yeah. That's a very succinct.
Good Lord. I know. I'm succinct, if not crass. speaking of crass, so back to comedy.
Sure.
You know, I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you've ever met him in your travels, but Patton Oswalt is a big supporter of the illustration world.
He is, yeah. He's a big comic arts fan.
Oh my gosh. Not just comic arts, but illustration, poster art.
Yeah.
You know, he routinely tweets things like, "Hey everybody, check out this illustrator."
Yeah.
You know, this person did the poster for such and such, or the album cover for this and that.
Yeah.
I love that.
I love that. I mean,
I love him.
Yeah. Patton Oswalt, it was the first comedian to ever make me cry laughing. That's true. 2008, it was the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. He did his KFC failure bowl bit.
Yep,
I was weeping. He was doing a lot. I mean, basically there's a club. Everyone, all the comedians who were doing shows, we do one show every night for 30 days. And Patton was in town for the festival. And afterwards, after everyone's finished their show, they go to this club all together and perform for each other, which is really tough audience. I mean, because comedians don't laugh. They go, if something's funny, they go, that's good. That's funny.
Right.
It was him and Mario Joyner were doing with the comedians on the lineup that night. And I couldn't even hear anything Mario Joyner was saying because I was still laughing. There was something about Patton's delivery and his writing style and his, how he just loads joke on joke on joke. He's also, you're right. He's a staunch advocate for illustrators and artists, and he gets artists to illustrate his album covers.
Yep.
Yeah. We actually considered him, we still are, for the ACE Award, which is an award that the National Cartoonist Society gives out to pretty much celebrities who wanted to be an artist, but, you know, fame got in the way. Like, we've given it to, like, Weird Al Yankovic and Jake Tapper and all these people.
Yeah, I was just going to mention Jake Tapper. He wanted to be a cartoonist, right?
Yeah, we gave it to him in 2018. He came to the Ruben Awards, and it was funny because he really, still to this day, he retweets a lot of cartoonists, and he did a foreword to the 60 Years of Mad magazine book.
Nice.
And yeah, it's and so Patton is in the running for the ACE Award, I should say.
Cool.
To this day, I can't look at Ham without thinking of the bit about a time traveler coming to see the giant guy at the deli counter saying, "I want all the ham." It's one of the funniest bits. If you haven't heard it, look it up. Oswald, best. He's the best.
He is the best. Have you done any shows in Philadelphia?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
If and when that happens again, let me know, because I'm not too far from it.
Absolutely, yeah. There was a great club in Allentown, too, that just closed recently that I used to perform. Yeah, I always love getting out of New York to perform in the Midwest and in the – and you know.
Right.
I mean,
same
honestly,
jokes, I assume? The exact same jokes? No, I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah, good one. That's a good joke. Yeah. But it's always good to get a gauge on your ideas and material with outside of a bubble. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Gosh, I'd love to. I have like another page of notes, believe it or not, that I'm going to completely ignore.
So, I'll have to come back again.
Yeah, there you have it. You know, we do have illustrators listening. If you could only share one piece of advice,
oh wow,
what would it be?
Well, apart from don't be afraid to kill your darlings, you throw your work away and start over. I would say, you know what? Any illustrators working who are kind of newish, I would say some of the best advice is turn your work in early. I know that sounds like a nice to have, but always turn it in early. And then even if they don't see it for 3 days, it'll prove that you're a professional. Never turn your work in on time. So if there's a deadline for January 12th, at least turn it in on January 11th. And I know that for tight turnaround stuff, it doesn't apply, but you've got an assignment, you've got a book, you've got a thing, always turn it in a little bit early, because that's the difference between a professional and an amateur, I think.
To learn more about Jason, visit jasonchatfield.com. If you find value in this podcast, please consider supporting it as a patron. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustration-DEPT. In return, you can receive our soft enamel pin, a reusable discount code for 10% off, access to dozens of patron-only episodes that we call Extra Credit, and more. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit illustration-DEPT.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.